Okay, first let's just read through Micah 5:2 before we discuss it. So follow along with me in your scriptures. But as for you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me, for you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel. His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. Short, but a lot of meaning in it. Okay, let's look at the notes and get a little historical background. Some of this we're going to be familiar with. Micah, the prophet Micah, was a contemporary of Isaiah. Now, we've already talked about Isaiah when we did Isaiah 7:14 the last couple weeks. But he ministered in a different part of Judah than Isaiah. So they weren't in exactly the same place, but they were both prophets of Judah. He prophesied from approximately 738 to 690 BCE during the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So you can see that Isaiah and Micah were contemporaries. During Micah's ministry, Jerusalem was besieged by the Babylonian army. In 597 BCE, while Jehoiakim was king of Judah, the Babylonians conquered Judah, laid it waste, and destroyed its temple. They also led the people of Judah into captivity in Babylon. So this is the Babylonian captivity. Now, remember, significant difference between the Babylonian captivity and the Assyrian deportation, we might call it, is that when Israel was taken away by Assyria, they never came back. The Babylonian captivity, they left, they were there for 70 years and they came back. Okay. From the human perspective, it was the might of Babylon that brought this calamity on Judah. However, the prophets made it clear that it was not the might of Babylon, but the Jewish people's disobedience to God that led to their downfall. Again, bear in mind that for Israel, living in the land, obedience to God meant living in the land and being blessed. Disobedience in the extreme could mean expulsion from the land, and which would also mean danger for them because they were no longer in their safe haven. There can be no doubt that Micah 5:2 talks of the Messiah. The predictions that he will come forth from God, be ruler in Israel, and most especially that his goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity, can only apply to the Messiah. Okay, now, number three is important. We want to go through this carefully. The word but in Micah 5:1 sets up a contrast between verses 1 and 2. Notice it says in verse 1, now muster yourselves in troops, daughter of troops. They have laid siege against us. With a rod they will smite the judge of Israel in the cheek. So that's talking about the judgment that's going to come upon Judah, right? But as for you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, too little to be amongst the clans of Judah, from you one will come forth from you to be ruler in Israel. Now, you see the contrast there, judgment, and then this prophecy about the Messiah. And something is similar is happening here that we saw happen in Isaiah 7. There's going to be this horrid judgment on Judah, but what verse 2 is telling us, among other things, is that the Davidic covenant is secure. You see it? In spite of this judgment, the king will still come forth from Bethlehem. Okay, now, the word but in Micah 5:1 sets up a contrast between verses 1 and 2. Whereas verse 1 speaks of the imminent degradation of the judge, that is the king of Israel, verses 2 and following predict the coming mighty leader who will restore the Jewish people to their homeland and be their shepherd and their peace. So we see that there's going to be some very difficult times for Judah, but the Davidic covenant will remain secure and from the line of David will come the leader, the final king of Israel. Micah 5:2 gives us five important pieces of information about the Messiah. So it's short, but it's important. First, the birthplace of Messiah. Messiah will be born in Bethlehem Ephrathah. Second, the humanity of the Messiah. And we're going to go over all of these. We'll see all of these. I'm just going to list them first. Third, the kingship of Messiah. Fourth, the deity of Messiah. And E, which I somehow missed put in, so write this in here, E, the security of the Davidic covenant. I have to get that in there. So first, let's talk about the birthplace of the Messiah. In verse 2, Micah predicts that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem Ephrathah. Ephrath is the ancient name of Bethlehem. Bethlehem means house of bread, and Ephrathah comes from a root meaning fruitful. Both names refer to the fertility of the region. It was a very fertile region. Bethlehem Ephrathah distinguishes the Bethlehem about which Micah writes from other towns named Bethlehem. There were other towns named Bethlehem. We have that in the United States too. Sometimes you live in a town and you're traveling and all of a sudden you say, hey, this town is the same town as my town. Such as the one in Zebulun. There was a Bethlehem in Zebulun. Bethlehem Ephrathah was about 6 Roman miles southwest of Jerusalem. A Roman mile is 1,618 English yards, thus 142 yards less than the English statute mile. It was approximately a mile. So what we have is, if it says here that it was 6 Roman miles southwest of Jerusalem, what that would mean would be, here's my crazy pictures I draw. This represents Israel. And remember, it was divided, so this is Israel, this is Judah. And I don't know, if Jerusalem was right over here, let's say, then Bethlehem Ephrathah would be 6 miles southwest. That's approximately where it'd be. Not too far from Jerusalem, just 6 miles. Okay? So it's pretty close to Jerusalem, where Messiah was born. Okay. Question? No, well, it says southwest. I can double check it if you send me an email, but I'm pretty sure it's southwest. Let me check. What does it say here? Southwest. Yes, yeah, southwest of Jerusalem. But who knows? I'm old. I might have been, you know. Okay, C. The Messiah who would deliver his people was to be born in an insignificant small town. This was more like a village than a city. Not even mentioned in the list of towns in Joshua 15 or Nehemiah 11. So it was pretty insignificant where the clans of Judah lived. This conforms with the lowly status of David, who was also born in Bethlehem Ephrathah, and also the lowly status of Yeshua and his family. And we've already established that they came from lowly means. We did that before when we looked at the sacrifice they gave when they dedicated them at the temple. Okay, so the first thing it tells us and the thing most people think about when they think about Micah 5:2 is the birthplace of Messiah would be Bethlehem Ephrathah. But it also tells us about the humanity of Messiah. Now, the scriptures teach that God the Son would come from heaven. Proverbs 30, verse 4. who has ascended in the heaven and descended, who has gathered the wind in his fists, who has wrapped the waters in his garment, who has established all the ends of the earth, what is his name or his son's name? Surely you know. So the Messiah would come from heaven. But notice what it says here. In Micah 5:2a, Micah refers to the humanity of Messiah. Like all human beings, he would come forth from an earthly birthplace. So in Micah 5:2, when it says, "From you one will come forth for me to be ruler in Israel," the "you" is Bethlehem, right? The Messiah is going to come forth from heaven, that's his deity, but he's also going to come forth from Bethlehem, that's his humanity. All right, now, it also talks about the kingship of Messiah. Verse 2c, it says, "From you will come forth for me, one will come go forth for me to be ruler in Israel." The one who would come forth from Bethlehem Ephrathah would be ruler in Israel. The expression "go forth" in verse 2 primarily means to conduct one's activities. It's more than just, it doesn't really mean taking a trip. It means conducting one's activities. Here God, through Micah, expresses the fact that King Messiah will minister on behalf of him. He will go forth and accomplish the purposes of the Father. Bethlehem was often referred to as the city of David because that is where David was born. Messiah's birth in the city of Bethlehem Ephrathah indicates that he was from the tribe of Judah. Now, let me stop there for a minute. Remember when they took a census In the New Testament, that census they took, and Mary and Joseph went to Bethlehem. Well, here's something interesting. They traveled, they had to travel from where they lived to Bethlehem to take part in the census. And I heard a liberal theologian once say, "The Bible's wrong. That's a very inefficient way to take a census. Why do people have to travel, you know? I mean, when they take the census in the United States, you get something in the mail, you fill it out, and you mail it in. You don't go anywhere." And his argument was, that's wrong. People didn't travel around to take a census. But he doesn't know about, he's obviously ignorant about Jewish history. When they took a census in Israel, they did it by tribes. That's how they always did it. And so that's why Mary and Joseph traveled to Bethlehem, because they were from the tribe of David, and that's where they had to register for the census. So when they would take a census in Israel, if somebody was from a certain tribe and not living on the land, on the parcel of land given to that tribe, that's where they had to travel there to take part in the census. Originally, when they took a census, that wasn't necessary because everybody lived in the parcel of land given to the tribe of their forefathers. Follow that? So that's why they had to travel there. Okay? Okay, let's go see again. Bethlehem was often referred to as the city of David because it is where David was born. Messiah's birth in the city of Bethlehem Ephrathah indicates that he was from the tribe of Judah. Because Bethlehem was in the parcel of land given to Judah. For Bethlehem was located on the parcel of land allotted to the tribe of Judah when the land was divided among the tribes in Joshua. Long after the land was divided, members of the tribe of Judah still occupied Bethlehem Ephrathah, but some did travel other places. Being from the tribe of Judah was a requirement for being the Messiah. Remember we saw that? Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah. We've already seen that. This, along with the genealogical records in the temple, confirmed that Yeshua was from the tribe of Judah and also a descendant of the Judahite King David, another requirement for being the Messiah. Okay? So, Micah 5:2 is short, but it's telling us a lot about the Messiah. Tells us where he was born, tells us he was a king, tells us that he was from the tribe of Judah, which was necessary for him to be the Messiah. Now, it also tells us, next page, about the deity of the Messiah. although the ruler, and go back to this, look in your Bible for a second. You see in verse 2 where it says, go forth, see that? From you one will go forth. See it in verse 2? Now look in the next line, still in verse 2, his goings forth. That's Hebrew parallelism. And it's antithetical parallelism because there's a contrast that's going to be set up here. In verse 2, when it says, from you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel, that's his humanity. He's going forth in his humanity to be king. But when it says his goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity, that's his deity. See it? Now read with me. Although the ruler comes from Bethlehem and from time in his humanity, it is also said that his goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. The above phrase contains the strongest possible statement of infinite duration in the Hebrew language. The days of eternity. The scriptures are clear. Only God is eternal. Micah 5:2 is a clear assertion of Messiah's deity. And let's read Isaiah 43:1-13, which discusses the eternal nature of God. I, even I, am the Lord, and there is no Savior besides me. It is I who have declared and saved and proclaimed, and there was no strange God among you. So you are my witnesses, declares the Lord, and I am God. Even from eternity, I am He. So here God is claiming to be from eternity. And in Micah 5:2, we're told that Messiah is going forth or from the day of eternity. Therefore, Messiah is God. And there is none who can deliver out of my hand. I act and who can reverse it. Messiah's going forth are mentioned twice in Micah 5:2, once in regards to his humanity, one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel, and once in regards to his deity, his goings forth are from long ago in the days of eternity. In this verse, the incarnation is implied in beautiful Hebrew parallelism. There we get a picture of the incarnation, human and God in the same person. Messiah, as the perfect son of his father, would go forth and obediently accomplish all his father's will. Also, Messiah, the son of God, was an active participant in ancient times. The God of the Old Testament is the second person of the Trinity. And in eternity, John 1:3. Actually, John 1:1-3. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God, implying his eternal nature. And in John 1:3, it says, let me get the exact wording. In John 1:3, it says, when I get there, all things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. That implies eternality, that he predated the existence of all that exists apart from himself. Okay, next page. Any questions on Micah 5:2? So what we see in Micah 5:2 is that Messiah would come from Bethlehem. He had to be born in Bethlehem. That he would be human. That he would be a ruler. He would be a king. And there's also indications of his deity. His goings forth are from of old, from everlasting, from the days of eternity. Questions, comments? Yes. King David was born in Bethlehem, and so that therefore King David was from the tribe of Judah, and Mary and Joseph traveled to Bethlehem because they were from the tribe of Judah. It says that in the New Testament. That's why they went to Bethlehem for the census, which means Yeshua. And we know the story that Yeshua was born in Bethlehem. And he was a Judahite. He was from the tribe of Judah, which qualifies him to be the Messiah. Well, what happened was this. This is what happened. Originally, where's my eraser? How can I teach? I can't teach. Thank you. What are you laughing? I need an eraser. How can I erase? I can't use that. That's messed up. This is what happened originally. I'll just show you. Here's Israel. Now, two of the tribes, this is a river, wanted to stay on that side of the river. But then, before the divided kingdom, the land was divided up among the tribes. Okay? So there were all these divisions in the land. And if this was the land, the parcel of land assigned to Judah, that's where all the people from Judah, from the tribe of Judah lived, all the descendants of Judah. If you look at the divisions, there's only 11. There was no land for the priests. The priests were not given a parcel of land. They served God in Jerusalem at the temple. The Levites, right. The tribe of Levi was not given a parcel. Okay? Excuse me? Prior to... This is prior to there being kings in Israel. Right. Yeah. Well, this is from starting from verse 3. Therefore, he will give them up until the time when she who is in labor has borne a child. I would have to check that out to get the exact interpretation of that verse. But it seems as though what it's implying is that God is going to... God's relationship with Israel will not be what it had been until the child is born. But I'd have to check that out. Yeah, I'd have to check that out. Okay, next. Let's see how we're doing here. Oy, time flies. The nature and rule of the Messiah, Isaiah 9, 6, and 7. Okay, let's read it first. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. Let's take a look at it. First, historical background. This was written by Isaiah, so we're already familiar with him. Isaiah prophesied from approximately 739 to 681 BCE during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, all kings of Judah. Isaiah was a prophet of Judah. These years in Israel's history were a time of great struggle, both politically and spiritually. We saw that when we studied Isaiah 7. The northern kingdom of Israel was deteriorating politically, spiritually, militarily, and finally fell to the Assyrian Empire in 722. The southern kingdom of Judah looked as though it would also collapse and fall to Assyria, but it was able to withstand the Assyrian army. During this time of political struggle and spiritual decline, Isaiah was raised up by God to deliver a message to the people. They should not rely on Egypt or any other nation to protect them. Rather, they should trust in the Lord God, who had promised them a glorious kingdom through Moses and David. The Lord was the only one who could protect them and was the only protection they would need. So that was part of Isaiah's message. Isaiah's prophecy in 9, 6, and 7 was made during the reign of Ahaz. Ahaz was an ungodly king, we've seen that, who led his people astray. His decisions, for example, to forsake God and worship the Baals and to rely on foreign powers for safety instead of God, brought ruin to the people of Judah. In chapters 9, 1 to 5, Isaiah prophesied that a time would come when the doom and darkness, when the doom and darkness Judah was experiencing would be a thing of the past. In contrast to the unwise leadership of Ahaz, whose foolish counsel had resulted in suffering and calamity, a wonderful counselor, the Messiah, would come and would lead the people from spiritual darkness into light. So in a sense, Messiah is being contrasted with Ahaz here. When the Messiah came, the weapons of warfare would be destroyed. We see that actually in verse 7. In Isaiah 9 and verse 7, which is not actually, it says, there will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace. So it's going to be a time of peace and not warfare. In contrast with the unwise leadership of Ahaz, whose foolish counsel had resulted in suffering and calamity, a wonderful counselor of the Messiah would come and would lead the people from spiritual darkness into life. When the Messiah came, When the Messiah came, the weapons of warfare would be destroyed because his reign of universal peace implements of war would not be needed. That reminds us of another passage we're probably familiar with. They shall beat their swords into plowshares. Okay, the passage. The first phrase of Isaiah 9:6 contains antithetic, that means contrasting parallelism. Notice it says, a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us. Child is parallel to son, born is parallel to given, and they're contrasting, as we'll see. They contrast with one another. All right. Child in the first line contrasts with son in the second line, and born in the first line contrasts with given in the second line. Both the humanity and the deity of the Messiah are expressed in this beautiful Hebrew poetry. In his humanity, the Messiah would have a beginning. He would be born like any other child. That's line one. See it? A child will be born. However, in his deity, Messiah, the Son of God, had no beginning. He is eternal. Therefore, in line two, the prophet does not say a son will be born to us, indicating a beginning of existence. Rather, he says a son will be given to us, indicating pre-existence. See the difference? The contrast between born and given is a beautiful poetic expression of the incarnation, God taking on human flesh. It is significant that in both lines, Isaiah uses the phrase to us. Here, Isaiah was identifying with his people and asserting that the child, a son, was to be born as one of the covenant people. Isaiah declares that the child who will be born to us, the Jewish people, shall be a king. The government shall rest upon his shoulders. So there's more confirmation the Messiah is going to be king of Israel, and that's in fulfillment of the Davidic covenant. The government will rest on his shoulders figuratively refers to the kingly robe worn by the Messiah. And for example, look in Revelation 19:16. And on his robe and on his thigh, he had a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Kings used to wear a robe. They used to do that in England, too, long ago. They wore a robe that signified their kingly status. B. In ancient Jewish culture, a person's name often summed up his character. The wise, wonderful nature of the son's rule is expressed in the four names given to him in verse 6b. His name shall be called 1, Wonderful Counselor. There are words in the Hebrew which are only used of God and never of men. One example is bara, which means to create. Bara is only used of God and what God does, never of man and what man does. Another Hebrew word that is reserved exclusively for that which is divine is pele, which translates into the English word wonderful. So wonderful counselor is an indication of the deity of the Messiah. Thus, the fact that pele is one of the names given to the Son is clear evidence that the Son is divine. Now, read Judges 13, this little passage with me. We're not going to read the whole thing, but read the beginning with me and you'll see something interesting. This is when Manoah and his wife saw the Lord in the book of Judges. And watch what it says. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, the angel of the Lord is always the second person of the Trinity when he appears in the Old Testament. What is your name so that when your words come to pass, we may honor you? But the angel of the Lord said to him, why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful? And that word is only used of God. And so we see the second person of the Trinity here, the Son of God, is deity. Pele is the nearest word to... Two should be the. The Hebrew has to the idea of supernatural. The Son would possess wisdom far above any human wisdom. His wisdom would even surpass the wisdom of Solomon, for although Solomon was the wisest man on earth, his wisdom was earthly and thus inferior to the heavenly wisdom of the Son. And 1 Kings 3:11 to 12, we really don't have to read, but this is where God says to Solomon, ask me for anything you want. And Solomon, so I'm paraphrasing, says, give me the wisdom to rule these people. And God says to Abraham at the end, behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before you, nor shall anyone like you arise after you, with the exception of the Messiah. Okay, E. In the kingdom, many people will desire to hear Messiah's wonderful counsel. This wonderful time is beautifully described in Isaiah 2, 2 and 3. Now it will come about that in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of mountains and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream into it. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So this is descriptive of the wonderful counsel that the Lord will give during his millennial reign as king. Yes? We don't know to what extent Isaiah knew. Let's put it this way. Remember, Isaiah did not have the completed scriptures as we do. So we're not really sure of how much Isaiah was aware of. Probably more than most people give him credit for, but not as much as we have, because we have the completed scripture. Okay, he's also referred to as the Mighty God. The repetition of this title in 10:21, referring to the Lord himself, establishes Isaiah's meaning here. The Son would be God. And look what it says in Isaiah 10:21. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the Mighty God. So there he's referred to as specifically as God. Some have suggested that this simply means a godlike person or hero. Such translations are linguistically faulty and ignored the implication that the Tanakh looks forward to a divine Messiah. The Son would be God himself incarnate in human flesh. Now here's something that gives people some trouble. He's also referred to as the Eternal Father. Many people are puzzled by this title because the Bible clearly distinguishes between God the Son and God the Father. So the question is, how can the Son be referred to as Eternal Father? Several things must be noted in this regard. One, the God of the Bible is Echad, which translates unity. He is one God with one set of attributes. However, God exists as three distinct persons who share equally in the essence, attributes, and character of God. The Messiah, being the second person of the triune God, is in his essence God. Therefore, he has all the attributes of God, including eternality. Now, this is the important part. The title Everlasting Father is an idiom used to describe Messiah's relationship to time, not his relationship to other members of the Godhead. That's very important. In Isaiah 9:6, when it says, his name shall be called Mighty God, Eternal Father. That's referring to his relationship to time, not the other persons of the Godhead. Four, because God the Son is eternal, he is said to be everlasting, just as the Father is called the Ancient of Days in Daniel 7:9. And finally, five, perhaps Isaiah had in mind the promise to David about the foreverness of the kingdom, which would come through David's line. The Messiah, as descendant of David, or it should say a descendant of David, will fulfill this promise for which the nation of Israel has been waiting. Isaiah's use of Father as a title of the Son speaks of his concern for his people, his protection of his people, and his care for and loving discipline of his people. So it's not implying that the Son is the Father at all. He has fatherly qualities in relationship to his people. But Eternal Father refers again not to Messiah's relationship with the other members of the Trinity, but his relationship with time, that is eternal. He's also referred to as the Prince of Peace. The Son is the Prince of Peace, the one who will usher in and maintain the time of millennial peace, when the nation of Israel, as well as all the nations, will be properly related to the Lord. Peace is personal fulfillment, well-being, harmony, and peace especially with God. The verb salem, S-A-L-E-M, is the transliteration, which translates peace, means to be whole or complete. Prince corresponds to our idea of administrator. This prince then, himself a whole personality and at one with God and with his people, will administer the benefits of peace and wholeness to his people. Messiah's reign will reflect the holiness and righteousness of God and will be guaranteed by the passionate commitment, truthfulness, and sovereignty of the Lord. Five. Like Messiah, who as God is immutable, and that means unchanging, never changes in his attributes or his character, Messiah's rule will be unchanging in its character. It will be a reign of eternal peace. His rule and the peace it brings will be without end in space and time. A. Messiah's reign as king will fulfill the promise God made to David that your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. We can see how important this Davidic covenant is. It's mentioned in many prophecies. Unlike many of the unrighteous kings of Israel and Judah, Messiah's reign on the throne of David will be established and upheld with righteousness and justice. Also, unlike the kings of Israel and Judah, whose reigns were temporary, Messiah's reign will be from then on and forevermore. Verse 7. The rule of Messiah will be accomplished by the zeal of the Lord of hosts. Now, that word zeal is significant because in Psalm 69:9, it says of Messiah, zeal for thy house will consume me. And that's repeated in John 2:17 when Messiah cleansed the temple. And his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for thy house will consume me. Zeal is a passionate commitment. The fulfillment of this prophecy rests not only on the faithfulness and sovereignty of God, but also on God's passionate commitment that his purposes and promises will come to pass. The word will should be in there. It is God's sovereign will that this prophecy and all biblical prophecies be fulfilled, as God himself has said, I act and who can reverse it? The fulfillment of the prophecy is certain. Questions? Comments? Okay, let's take our first break. Okay, we're on page 178, the forerunner of the Messiah. Isaiah 43 through 5. So let's read. A voice is calling, clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness. Make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Let every valley be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. And let the rough ground become plain, and the rugged terrain a broad valley. Then the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh will see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Okay, now this is again from Isaiah. Like other prophets, Isaiah was given vision, but he also heard words. And notice what it says, a voice is calling. So this was an audible. This was not a vision. This was given to him audibly. In this passage, an unidentified voice calls out to Isaiah and through Isaiah to the Jewish people. The voice tells them to prepare the way for the Lord and his glory. All four gospel writers applied Isaiah 43 to John the Immerser. And I have the particular passages there from the Gospels. John was a desert prophet who prepared the way for the Messiah and who made a highway for him in the wilderness. And those two are parallel. Highway in the wilderness is kind of figurative, preparing the way for the Messiah. And in Matthew 3:1-4, we read, In those days, John the Immerser came preaching in the wilderness of Judea, saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. For this is the one referred to by Isaiah the prophet, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, make ready with the way for the Lord, make his path straight. Now John himself had a garment of camel's hair and a leather belt about his waist, and his food was locust and wild honey. So we know that John the Immerser fulfilled Isaiah 43 through 5. Isaiah 35:8-10, and let's take a real quick look at that, so we can have it in front of us. Isaiah 35:8-10, here's what it says. A highway will be there, a roadway, and it will be called the highway of holiness. The unclean will not travel on it, but it will be for him who walks that way, and fools will not wander on it. No lion will be there, nor will any vicious beast go up on it. These will not be found there, but the redeemed will walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord will return and come with joyful shouting to Zion, with ever joy upon their heads. They will find gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Now, this is talking about, of course, the millennium. But notice that phrase in there, that highway. Now, Isaiah 35:8-10 had spoken of a highway for the exiles returning from Babylon, implying that perhaps it would traverse the desert. We get that from Isaiah 35:1. The wilderness and the desert will be glad, and the Araba will rejoice and blossom like a crocus. However, in the Tanakh, the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel and the returning to God often go hand in hand. While God would not allow any obstacle to prevent the return of the Jewish people to their homeland, there was yet another return to be accomplished with its own set of obstacles. In Isaiah's day, the entire nation was in a spiritual wilderness, and each Jewish person had to, and you see where I have get ready? I think be ready would be ready, would be made ready would be a better. Each Jewish person had to be made ready for the appearing of the Lord and his glory. I think that's a better way to say it. Thus, whereas the Jewish people would traverse a physical highway in returning to their homeland to wait for the Messiah, they also had to traverse a spiritual highway in order to be ready for him when he came. The Lord would use Cyrus, who allowed the Jewish captives to return to their homeland in Jerusalem and build their temple, as his tool to build the highway on which the Jewish people would return to their homeland. Now here's something very interesting. The prophecy that Cyrus would be used of God is found in Isaiah 45, 1-4, written in the 8th century B.C. The fact that he did it is recorded in Ezra 1, 2, and 3, written in the 5th century BCE. So 3 centuries in advance, God not only prophesied that this would happen, but named the king who would make the proclamation causing it to happen. Pretty fascinating. He would use John the Immerser as his tool to build this spiritual highway, a highway of repentance, which his people would traverse in making themselves ready for Messiah's coming. Lifting up the valleys, making every mountain and hill low, and letting the rough ground become a plain refers to workmen smoothing out the roads on which a dignitary would travel when he came to visit an area. It's kind of like rolling out the red carpet, you know, making his entranceway into a city smooth. One, in Isaiah's day, he was calling the Jewish people to be smoothed out, that is, repent, so that the Lord would come to Israel and rule. Thus, the geographical features in Isaiah 41-3 symbolize the arid lifelessness of the unrepentant soul. The hills may represent the carnal pride of the sinner, and the valleys his moods of carnal hopelessness and self-pity. The glory of the Lord would be revealed through Cyrus's liberation of the exiled Jewish people from the Babylonian captivity and their restoration to the land of promise, and especially through their liberation from the bondage of sin through the work of their Messiah. When Isaiah wrote, "Then the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh will see it together," he had in view the millennial kingdom when the Lord will be revealed in his glory, that is, when his unique splendor will be evident everywhere. Elsewhere, Isaiah wrote about Messiah's suffering and glorification. However, like the other authors of the Tanakh, Isaiah did not recognize the time interval between Messiah's first coming to suffer and his second coming to rule. And we've already established that gap in the Old Testament. Though the disciples saw Yeshua's glory, for example, John 1:14, okay, all flesh has not yet seen it. In John 1:14, John said, "We have beheld his glory, but all flesh has not yet seen it." However, they will see it in the millennium. This is certain because the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. So in summary, Isaiah 43-5 predicts the coming of a forerunner who would clear the way for the coming of the Messiah by turning the hearts of the Jewish people back to God so that they might be prepared for his coming. Now, just so I can point something out to you, the forerunner is also mentioned at the very end of the Old Testament in the book of Malachi, chapter 4. And I just want to point this out so we don't get confused. In Malachi chapter 4, at the very end, Malachi chapter 4, verse 5, 6, listen what it says. Behold, I am going to send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of the Lord. He will restore the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, so that I will not come and smite the land with a curse. So a forerunner is being prophesied here too as well, right? However, the passage we just studied, Isaiah 40, refers to the first coming of the Messiah. Malachi 4, 5, and 6 refers to the second coming. They don't refer to the same event. Okay? Okay, moving on. Any questions on that one? You mean in Malachi?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And then the one that John...
It says, I will send you Elijah the prophet, so it seems as though there's no reason not to take it literally. Uh-huh. But we know that, for example, John the Immerser, Yeshua said he was Elijah.
Right.
But he came in the spirit and the power of Elijah, so that's a tough call. Yeah, but that's not really relevant. There's people who take the fact that he never died and do something with that. That's not really relevant to these particular prophecies. There's also people who say that the two witnesses in Revelation are going to be Elijah and Enoch because they never died. But there's also people who say there'll be Moses and Elijah. There's all kinds of speculation. The scriptures aren't really, they're a little bit obscure on that point. All right, next on page 181, the nature and the rule of the Messiah, Jeremiah 23, 5 through 8. So turn to the book of Jeremiah. To help you find it a little faster, Jeremiah comes after Genesis but before Revelation. Why do you laugh? Why the mockery? Okay, Jeremiah chapter 23. Yes. Thank you very much. You narrowed it down quite well. Jeremiah 23, and we want to read verses 5 through 8. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch. Now, just so you know, the word branch there can be translated sprout, and that's going to be significant. And he will reign as king and act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell securely. And this is the name by which you will be called, the Lord, our righteousness. Okay, go to the notes. This passage primarily relates to Messiah's second coming. However, it does reveal some important things. This, what's the word this doing there? It should be things about Messiah that apply to both his first and second coming. Comings. Okay, let's get some historical background. In Jeremiah's day, the kings were likened to shepherds who were destroying and scattering the sheep of my pasture. In Jeremiah's day, the kings were not godly. They were ungodly and were leading the people away from God. God said that he would judge, attend to them for their evil deeds. Okay, now here's events related to the second coming. The days are coming is a messianic formula which Jeremiah uses to direct special attention to what he stated. The phrase is used 15 times in the book of Jeremiah, and when it is, the reader should pay special attention to what follows it. The key idea in this passage is that in contrast to the troublesome times of Jeremiah's day, there will be a time of blessing ahead. The promise is focused on David and the promise made to him in the Davidic covenant that your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever, your throne shall be established forever. So again, we see the reference to the Davidic covenant. The following events recorded in this passage relate to Messiah's second coming. Now again, this is a study on the first coming, but since this has aspects of both the first and second, we should cover it, you know, in its entirety. Okay. The days are come... where am I? Oh. The evil kings would one day be removed, and God himself would gather the remnant of my flock out of all the countries which I have driven them, and they shall bring them back, and shall bring them back to their pasture, that's Israel, and they will be fruitful and multiply. That's in 23:3, just preceding the passage. God would then raise up shepherds over them, and they will tend them, and they will not be afraid any longer, nor be terrified, nor will any be missing. That's in 23:4. In verse 5, God describes the reign. It should be of the chief shepherd who would accomplish what the ungodly kings could not do. During his reign, Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell securely. The prophecy goes on to say that during the reign of the chief shepherd, they will no longer say, as the Lord lives who brought up the sons of Israel from the Lord from the land of Egypt, but as the Lord lives who brought up and led back the descendants of the household of Israel from the northland and from all the countries where I had driven them. In other words, the final regathering from the four corners of the earth. Then they will live on their own soil. That's in 23:7-8. 1. The Exodus was the greatest event recorded in the Tanakh, the Old Testament. To the Jewish people, the Exodus had a very special meaning. It was the time when God set them free from the bondage of slavery, destroyed their enemies, and made what was a large company of people into Israel, God's chosen people, a nation. However, in this passage, Jeremiah tells us that an even greater day was coming. God would once again bring his people to the land promised to their forefathers, but this time, again, the word will is better would, it's bad English. This time, he would not merely lead them from Egypt to Israel, rather he would gather them from all the distant nations to which he had scattered them, and they would live on their own soil in Israel. That's in 23:8. Okay, now 6, the nature and office of the Messiah. And this is getting back towards the first coming. While the events described in the passage relate primarily to Messiah's second coming, the passage does give us important facts about the Messiah that are eternally true. So that apply to not only his first coming, but his second coming and to him at all times. Therefore, these facts relate to the first as well as the second coming of Messiah. Branch, which can also be translated sprout. And remember when we did Isaiah 11, 1-5, behold, from the stump of Jesse, a sprout shall spring forth. Okay. Is a messianic title indicating that the one being spoken of here is the coming Messiah. And I have some passages in which that's confirmed. The precise wording in Hebrew of the term righteous branch is tzadik tzemach, which could mean a righteous shoot or a true shoot of David's line, in contrast to the ungodly kings preceding him. Now look what it says in Isaiah 3. Now listen, Joshua, the high priest, you and your friends who are sitting in front of you, indeed, they are men who are a symbol, for behold, I am going to bring in my servant, the branch. For behold, the stone that I've set before Joshua, on one stone or 7 eyes, behold, I will engrave an inscription on it, declares the Lord of hosts. And I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, every one of you will invite his neighbor to sit under his vine and under his fig tree. That phrase, under his vine and under his fig tree, is an Old Testament idiom for peace, for peaceful dwelling. And in Zechariah 6, the word of the Lord also came to me, saying, take an offering from the exiles, from Heldai, Tobijah, and Jediah, and you go the same day and enter the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah, where they have arrived from Babylon, and take silver and gold, make an ornate crown, and set it on the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Then say to him, thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, a man whose name is Branch, for he will branch out from where he is, and he will build the temple of the Lord. Yes, it is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he who will bear the honor and sit and rule on his throne. Thus he will be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace will be between the two offices. So he's going to be a king and a priest. And we're going to talk about that later. The fact that he'll be both a king and a priest. C, we have seen previously that Messiah... Now, follow along with this, because this is we want to make sure we get this. Would be a descendant of David. And that no descendant of Jehoiakim would sit on David's throne. Everybody remember that? That's just the terrorists with bombs, don't worry. All right. D. This passage tells us that God would raise up another descendant of David who would be a king unlike Jehoiakim or any other king of Judah. In contrast with Jehoiakim, whose ungodly ways were condemned by the Lord, this king would be a righteous branch of David who would act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land. This king would be the final king of Israel who would fulfill the promises made to David and his people. He would be the Messiah, God's righteous branch. The key phrase in this passage concerning our study of Messiah's first coming is found in verses 5 and 6. Let's read verses 5 and 6 again. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he will reign as king and act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell securely, and this is his name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. Okay, now let's read. Did I turn this on? Yeah. Okay, now. As we shall see, verse 5 affirms Messiah's humanity, and verse 6 affirms his deity. You see where he says, I will raise, declares the Lord, when I raise up for David a righteous branch? That's humanity, right? Descendant of David. And you see where it says, in verse 6, the Lord our righteousness, that's his deity. So again, we have the incarnation implied in this passage. The Jewish people who deny the incarnation are really not familiar with the Old Testament scriptures, because it's all over the place. Okay, continuing. The fact that this passage, which refers primarily to Messiah's second coming, also expresses Messiah's deity and his humanity, indicates that Messiah's humanity and deity are permanent. He's still in his human body as he sits next to the Father. The Messiah's deity obviously has to be permanent, and his humanity is permanent as well. It had a beginning, but it has no end. The permanence of Messiah's humanity is affirmed in the Brit Chadashah, the New Testament. In 1 Timothy, Paul describes Messiah as being human after his resurrection, ascension, and as he is seated at the right hand of the Father. And he says, for there is one God and one mediator also between God and men, the man Messiah Yeshua. So the Lord, the second person of the Trinity, is still God incarnate. He's still in human, he still has a human body and always will. The permanence of Messiah's of Yeshua's humanity is also expressed in the book of Revelation. Now, this is beautiful because this is one of my favorite verses, and it expresses both his deity and his humanity. Watch this. I, Yeshua, have sent my angel to testify these things for the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David. Root implies deity, offspring implies humanity. See it? The bright morning star. I love that verse. Yeshua will forever be the root of David, an expression of his preexistence and deity. Consistency dictates that he will also forever be the offspring of David, an expression of his humanity. Verse 6 affirms the deity of Messiah. As we have seen previously, in ancient Israel, a person's name often revealed something about his character. Here, the Messiah is named the Lord our righteousness, and the Hebrew is Adonai Tzikenu. The Jewish people don't pronounce Jehovah, they say Adonai. So whenever you hear Adonai Tzikenu, that's the Lord our righteousness, an expression of Messiah's deity. Now, one argument presented by modern rabbinic Judaism to refute the teaching that the name the Lord our righteousness in verse 6 indicates deity is to point out that throughout the Tanakh there are names of people who are obviously not God that contain the name of God. For example, Jeremiah means Adonai will establish, or Jehovah will establish. And Isaiah means Adonai is salvation. So they argue just because the word Adonai or Jehovah is there doesn't necessarily mean his deity, but follow along with me. Thus, modern rabbinic Judaism denies that the name of God is being given to the one spoken of in Jeremiah 23:6, and in some cases, the rabbis deny that the passage speaks of Messiah at all. However, none of the names of people in the Bible, aside from Messiah, contain all four Hebrew letters that comprise the name Jehovah, Yud, He, Vav, He. Some names contain two of the letters, some contain three, but nowhere are all four letters of the name of God used in the name of it, in the name of it, well, in isn't, it should be for the name. For the name of a human being, the one exception is the name of the Messiah, which contains all four letters that comprise the name Jehovah. Yod, He, Vav, He. That's the only instance in the entire Bible where all four letters of the name of God are applied to a human. That the name of God was given to the Messiah was not disputed in ancient the ancient rabbis, who always interpreted Jeremiah 23, 5-8 as a messianic passage. It is only in relatively recent times that rabbis have argued otherwise. For example, the Midrash, a compilation of rabbinic teachings on the Bible from approximately 200 to 500 BCE, says this on Proverbs 19:21. Rabbi Hanu said, eight names are given to the Messiah, which are Yanan, Shiloh, David, Menachem, Jehovah, Justi de Nostra, Tzemach, Elias. The fifth name listed, Jehovah, is the name of God. This is based on the words of Jeremiah 23:6. The seventh name is Tzemach, or branch. This is based on Jeremiah 23:5. So we see the ancient rabbis did recognize that this was speaking of Messiah and of his deity. Also, see, the ancient Jewish people understood the name in 23:6 to be that of Messiah. The Targum, an Aramaic translation of the Tanakh, the Old Testament, written or compiled from the Second Temple period until the early Middle Ages, that's late in the first millennium, reads the Messiah of Righteousness. So there was never any dispute here until Messiah came, and then you can see what happened. But prior to the coming of Messiah, none of the rabbis had any problem with this speaking of Messiah and speaking of his deity. The name of the Messiah here is a wordplay on the name of King Zedekiah, a contemporary of Jeremiah. Zedekiah's Hebrew name was Siddiqiah, which translates into the English, "My righteousness is Jehovah," or Adonai. In contrast with King Zedekiah, the coming king would live up to his name as Israel's righteous ruler. In other words, it was true of Zedekiah that his righteousness was Jehovah, but what will be true of Messiah is that he will in fact be Jehovah. Thus, the righteous ruler that God would raise up in place of the unrighteous kings that have preceded him would be the Messiah, God in the flesh. In contrast with the kings who came before him, King Messiah will rule righteously, and during his reign in the millennium, Israel will live in the land promised to their forefathers. I don't like the way that reads. Israel will live in the land promised to their forefathers and will live in peace and safety. Oh, no, don't need it. Forget it. Will live in peace and safety, and the promise that God made to David in the Davidic covenant will be fulfilled. Conclusion. Jeremiah 23:5-8 is a messianic prophecy that looks forward to the day when God will gather the Jewish people back to the land of Israel and Messiah will rule righteously as king on David's throne, bringing peace and security to his people. Jeremiah 23:5-8 affirms that Messiah will permanently be both human and divine. He is and will forever be the root and the offspring of David, the bright morning star. Questions? Comments? Yes.
When it here where it refers to Israel or the offspring, would there be any, non-Jewish people that are grafted in?
Non-Jewish people, when Messiah died and the new covenant was not fulfilled, it has not yet been fulfilled for Israel, but because the new covenant is founded upon the death of Messiah, we today can enjoy the blessings of the new covenant. And one of the things that happened when the Messiah died also was that the middle wall of partition was broken down between Jews and Gentiles, and Gentiles were grafted into the promises of the Abrahamic covenant. That's the concept of being grafted in, that's what it is.
Right. So when it refers to Jewish people back in the land, it is referring only to the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or even though, coming out of Egypt, even though it was a mixed multitude, and then they were.
Well, that's not to say there won't be Gentiles there. That's fine. But the point is there will be Jews there, and all the Jews will be there. That's the important aspect of the prophecy.
And now, right now, with Jewish people going back to Israel, is that partial?
That is prophecy being fulfilled in our own time. That is a fulfillment of prophecy. Anything else? Okay.